How much to the Buddha? How much to the Dharma? How much to the Sangha? So a few of you may have heard, but last week when I was at Rohatsu, at Great Vow Zen Monastery, and Hogan and Chosen are the abbots there, and they were co-leading this retreat, and every day there was a Dharma talk. And they alternated, Hogan one day, Chosen the other. And on the first day, Hogan gave the talk, and I saw he unfolded his stuff like this, and I saw he had an idiot's guide. And I was kind of like, what kind of idiot's guide would he have, you know, for his Dharma talk? And he ended up reading a section from the idiot's guide that I wrote on Zen living during the Dharma talk. And then the next day, and he didn't say who it was by, he just said, you know, this idiot's guide Zen living. The next day, Chosen read something from it. And then Hogan, several days later, read something more from it. I'm like, I just did not ever expect to be like listening to a Dharma talk and have my words like being read to me. But I was very proud. All right, so today's talk, I'm calling Meditation is Not About Stopping Thought. And I pretty much just keep this in mind. Sometimes, I don't know about you, but I really do not, I don't like to be told what to do. I don't like to be talked down to. I don't really even like being given advice unless I've explicitly asked for it. So just keep in mind that generally speaking, when Dharma teachers are saying something, whether they're writing it or speaking it or saying it in Sanzen or whatever, they're talking to themselves. That is like, that's what you know, right? Like if you have wisdom to offer, it's because you have struggled with this or continue to struggle with it. So anyway, this is a talk that I kind of wish I had heard early on in my practice, but I strongly suspect I probably did hear and I just didn't absorb it. So anyway, it's just a common misunderstanding that meditation is about stopping your thoughts. I don't know if you've had this experience. If I mention to anybody that I'm a Buddhist, somebody would be like, oh yeah, I tried meditation once, but I'm no good at it. I just can't stop thinking. That's pretty much the standard, you know, or maybe somebody has continued, but then they'll think they're not good at it. And many of us think we're not good at it because, you know, well, you shouldn't just hear the number of thoughts that are going on in my mind while I sit there. So in this talk, I want to essentially cover two things. One, why do we so long to be free from thought? And two, then how meditation is not about stopping thought, but about diligently and repeatedly turning our attention to something beyond thought. Thereby just, I mean, it's difficult to describe what the results of that are, but I think of realigning our whole being, changing our whole relationship to thought and to our body and to reality and everything because of this repeated and diligent, whenever we wake up from that thought-centered trance, we just turn our attention to something that is other than thought, beyond thought, below thought, not dependent on thought. So when people experience lots of thoughts in meditation, which is most of us, usually we conclude either that this whole thing is a waste of time, or we might find the experience of sitting with our thoughts just unpleasant, or boring, or exhausting, or sometimes unbearable. So there's three reasons I can think of why facing the state of your mind in meditation can be uncomfortable. So one is there are things in your life you really don't want to look at or accept. And all I can say about that one is well, I recommend you face them anyway, because it doesn't really help to ignore them. It may be uncomfortable to face them, but we can't run away from them forever, and they will make their presence known in our life. Two, the content of our thoughts, and this is often, you know, this is why mindfulness and meditation has ended up being so central in modern psychology and stuff, because of addressing this. The content of your thoughts may be negative, painful, repetitive. So self-criticism, you know, mulling over past hurts and wrongs, or anxious worries about the future, or something that just our mind just gets on a uncomfortable, painful, or negative loop, and it's not fun. It's not fun to just be with that. The third is the content of your mind, and this is perhaps more often, but the content of your mind may be fairly innocuous or even pleasant, but it's just ceaseless and meandering. There's just a, you know, train of thoughts or a blur of thoughts or a stream of thoughts that are just kind of exhausting and pointless. Like, I don't know, you know, I mean, I'll rehash TV plots in my head and, you know, just like, so some of us with really busy minds, you know, feel like the first few years of meditation, I mean, are just like, I've heard other people use this metaphor, and I used it when I first started. It's like staring into a blender of thoughts. It's that, like, random and fast, and it's just unnerving. It's just like, what? It's not even a train of thoughts. It's like a blah. I mean, it's at least a train, which I wanted to say, like, I'll kind of get to this later, this whole thing of, like, do we get better at this? How soon should we get better at this? Should I be seeing progress? Should my thoughts be slowing down? I think we do get better at it, but most of us very slowly. So I have been sitting for 25 years, and I do find that in meditation retreats, you know, after several grueling days of meditation practice, there might be, you know, a few quieter moments, but I will say that blender of thoughts is now just kind of a relentless freight train of thoughts. So, I mean, at least I can, you know, I can see space kind of between the thoughts. I can see that this thought is connected to that thought, usually not by a whole lot, but just some vague, you know, connection. I see where that one led to that one. And, you know, on very rare occasions, maybe there's a few moments of stillness, but then, so this is where the train metaphor breaks down, because it may, like, kind of grind to a halt, but it speeds up again, just like it does. It's not like a train slowly speeding up, it's suddenly going again. So, I mean, I guess that's progress. But I think if I had heard somebody like me saying that at the beginning of my meditation practice, I might have found it kind of discouraging. Like, really? 25 years and now you're just down to a train? Then there's an additional discomfort with all of this, whatever kind of discomfort we're experiencing, that there's a discomfort in just recognizing how little control we have over this, that we have, like, all right, I'm gonna meditate. And then I'm just thinking about stuff. I mean, you know, who's in charge here? What? How do I do this? I mean, when I came back from Rohatsu, you know, and I had some nice still meditation at Rohatsu, and I'm like, you know, I can do this here. I can do this in my daily life. You know, and then it's like just thinking about stuff again. So it can seem. To find any space, so to find some freedom from this, can seem like an insurmountable, exhausting task. I had an image during Rohatsu of trying to move all of the sand off of a beach with a teaspoon. That's kind of what it's like. And then there's sand, you know, falling off the teaspoon as you walk, and then, like, you know, you go back to it. Just it seems impossible, which kind of the point of my talk today is it is impossible. So those of us who don't, many people give up meditation entirely because of this experience, and those of us who don't frequently doubt whether the effort is really worth it, harbor fantasies about maybe some other kind of spiritual practice that might be a little more effective. Maybe they give you a shovel to move the sand off the beach. And really, why do we long for that thoughtless state anyway? I mean, why do we continue, so many of us, you know, moving that sand off the beach with a teaspoon, even though we're like, I don't know. They just told me to do this. I think it's because we have all tasted moments of inner silence, whether they're in meditation or they're in some other time. We've tasted those moments, and they're wonderful. The din and clamor of our usual train or blender of thoughts, you know, quiets down. We come out of our, you know, thought-centered trance and kind of look around and become aware of things that ordinarily we're just completely shut down and oblivious to. We kind of exist in a place that's untouched and undefiled by our usual thoughts of inadequacy or arrogance or resentment or whatever. The next moment seems full of possibilities instead of just constrained by the same, like, karmic momentum. So I think there's a, you know, we're not just, there's a real longing there to experience some freedom from this relentless trance of thoughts. And I think in those moments where we do have that experience of some silence and stillness, I would call these brief tastes of samadhi. So samadhi is a Buddhist term often translated as concentration, meditative absorption, or one-pointedness. Some of you know, like, I believe there's different ways to meditation, and some of them are concentration and some of them are letting go. So I want to make it clear that samadhi is not only the territory of concentration practices, but that letting go practices, we can achieve the same kind of calm, openness, a calm, clear state of mind where dualistic thinking really slows down. For a moment it might even stop, but it's more like thoughts might appear, but they're just kind of blips within this larger space. And at the same time, then, there's little or no sense of separation from your experience. So you're just, there's a sense that you're just directly experiencing what's happening. So non-dual awareness is another word for this. Now, in Buddhism, samadhi is not an end in and of itself. It's pleasant, but plenty of us do strive for it and get attached to it if we experience it. But it is simply a calmness of mind where then we can investigate reality. We can investigate and see truths, aspects of self, aspects of reality. We're talking about, you know, emptiness and suchness and Buddha nature and whatever, aspects of reality that we ordinarily can't perceive because of that trance of thought. So in Buddhism, where we try to cultivate this samadhi for the sake of wisdom, for the sake of cultivating insight. So it's not a matter of, I had a moment of samadhi, although that's exciting, you know, I mean, it's like, that's to be celebrated. But then it's like, and then you investigate. So at Rohatsu, one of the teachers mentioned a metaphor, which is like the relationship between samadhi and wisdom or insight is like the relationship between a lamp and its light. So if the lamp is samadhi, its light is wisdom. I mean, that's the functioning of the lamp. But whether we're just enjoying samadhi or we're using it to investigate, doesn't this mean that if our meditation is about cultivating samadhi, which is a more or less thoughtless state, then isn't meditation about stopping our thoughts? So the answer, of course, is yes and no. So yes, part of our path is cultivating samadhi, dedication to our form of meditation, hoping that there are more moments of this kind of clarity, this kind of seeing through the fog of our thoughts. But no, stopping thoughts is not the goal of our meditation, because samadhi is not something that can be achieved as a goal in the ordinary sense. As soon as we set up a goal, we are separated from it. So now we have created, there's an I, and I'm striving on the meditation seat for this state, which I do not yet have. So we have created all of this, which is all dualistic, in order to attain a non-dual state of awareness, which just does not work. And it's really frustrating that it doesn't work, because like it's our go-to. This is how we do things. I mean, so part of our practice is kind of learning to like strive and recognize, okay, that doesn't work, and we strive and then we let go, and then this whole thing is a koan that we discover over the course of practice. Are we trying to do something? Are we not trying to do something? What happens when I don't try? I don't know. But you may have heard me say this one before, but Kyogen's analogy for samadhi is that you can't make it happen. You can only create the conditions for it. So it's like making a lap for a cat. So the samadhi cat, you know, you make the lap as best you can. You're trying to be still. You're trying whatever. And sometimes the samadhi cat will come, sometimes it won't. And if you see it coming on by, it doesn't help to try to grab it, you know? And once it's there for a moment, you don't, you know, you probably better not try to just like grab onto it. It's, you know, you're just creating the conditions, and then you're grateful when sometimes there's a little bit of space and quiet. And another reason meditation is not just about stopping thought or trying to achieve a thoughtless state is because meditation can, and I'll make this clear, it can be extremely beneficial even if you never experience identifiable moments of quote-unquote samadhi. Even if you never experience that, this is still a beneficial practice, which I'll get to. So we hope for some freedom from our thoughts. That's just human and natural. But we can't aim for that directly. We can't stop activity of mind with mind. So what we need to do is make some kind of effort that bypasses the mind entirely. So that's when we direct our attention. Once we wake up from that thought-centered trance, which in a way we have no control over. That just happens sometimes. We're not always in the thought-centered trance. There's certain moments where we kind of wake up. And then what do we do? So meditation is what we do at those moments when we wake up. And what we do is we turn our attention to something other than the thoughts, something other than the content of the thoughts or the activity of the thinking. So that may be our breath. That may be sound. That may be metta practice, or that may be shikantaza, which is just letting go of doing anything but physically sitting there. So it's returning to that, just the physical act of sitting there. And it's that we have to do this turning very, very gently, without the hint of an agenda, because otherwise the mind will get involved. You know, if we're too like, we want to concentrate and try to like let go of these thoughts, the mind will be like, yes, let's do that. Like, and the mind is, then you're just, once again, we're just striving and we've gotten the mind all agitated again. So it has to be a very gently like turning our mind back to our meditative object. And there can be, and this is part of this whole koan of meditation, I mean, there can be a diligence about that effort, a determination, a strength in that effort that isn't a striving, but it's tricky to do. So one of the, there's a Zen word that talks about what we're aiming for in meditation. And it's He Shir Yo, which is often translated as non-thinking. So in one of our Tuesday readings, Fukan Zazengi by Dogen, He Shir Yo is in part of this. So he says, once you have adjusted your posture, take a breath and exhale fully. Rock your body right and left and settle into steady, immovable sitting. And this is, I've always found this section infuriating, but hopefully my explanation will open it up for you. Think of not thinking. Not thinking, what kind of thinking is that? Non-thinking. This is the essential art of Zazen. So in that case, non-thinking is this He Shir Yo. So think of not thinking. Not thinking, what kind of thinking is that? Non-thinking, He Shir Yo. So shiryo means thinking, and he is a prefix of negation or opposition. And so I found an essay by a Reverend Tsunoda of the Japanese Soto school, and he had a short essay titled He Shiryo, Non-Thinking. And one of his translations of He Shiryo is not the matter of thinking. And I'm not sure, you know, maybe it's the Japanese translation, but like for me, that means it's not a matter of thinking. It's not a matter of thinking, or then by extension, not thinking. It's not about, it's just like, it's not even about that. It's all something else. That happened. So Tsunoda says that He Shir Yo is not about an absence of thought. He says to stop the operation of mind, intellect, and consciousness. So this is another part of Dogen's Fukan Zazengi, and stop measuring with thoughts, ideas, and views does not mean to totally stop all mental activities. To stop operation and measuring is a stopping of arbitrary thoughts and calculations rather than maintaining a state of having no thoughts during Zazen. The idea of having no thoughts is itself an arbitrary thought. So I like to think this is not about thinking or not thinking. It's like it's shifting our attention away from that whole arena. And in a way, you could say we're not striving for a thoughtless state in meditation, but we are trying to give up our attachment to thinking. So when we notice our discriminating mind, intellect, and consciousness are operating again, we just give them up. We just release. Uchiyama Roshi has this opening the hand of thought. So we've grasped it again, thinking, and then we just open that hand and allow the thoughts to pass away. We don't like push them away or wish them away. So interestingly, Tsunoda talks about there's another version of Fukan Zazengi, and it's one that's signed by Dogen. But I mean, the other one could have come later. We don't know which one is legit. But in this one that he signed, there's that whole thinking, not thinking part isn't in there, which is actually it refers to, that shows up in older koans. So there's other Zen literature that use that whole exchange. But in this version of Fukan Zazengi, in place of that passage, it says, when a thought arises, be aware of it. When you are aware of it, it will disappear. Continuously put aside everything outside and make yourself into one piece. I like that one a lot better myself. So you may have had this experience in meditation where like, oh, there's that annoying thought again. But when you turn your awareness to it, it usually just kind of melts away. If you're turning your awareness to it in a particular way, if you are kind of engaging it and following it, you know, sure, then you can keep it alive. But when you just kind of look at it and acknowledge it, it just kind of goes. So all we have to do is become aware. You don't have to analyze, push away, reject, figure out a way to keep thoughts from arising. That's my big one, right? Like I let go, I return to Shikantaza, and then there's part of me that's like, all right, now how am I going to like stay here and not let those thoughts arise again? And then they just, like, that doesn't help at all. So it's still, even though we may have heard this instruction many times, like, well, you know, don't worry about it, just let go of the thoughts, return to your meditative practice, it's still difficult for most of us to accept the almost nonstop chatter in our minds. We still long for that, you know, some stillness, some silence, some freedom from this, you know, trance of thought. Or at least part of us longs for it. Part of us clearly is, you know, perfectly happy to think about last night's TV plot. You know, so we have differing desires within us. And we stubbornly cling to the idea that our meditation should involve much less thinking than it does. And once again, like here, I am confessing. I experienced this last week. I have been meditating for 25 years, and I'm a Zen priest, and there's part of me just like, Jesus, this can't be it. This is like, no, I'm trying so hard. But most of us are going to just simply have to endure that endless stream of thoughts if we are going to experience the benefits of meditation. And part of this is like, it's just accepting our karma, accepting who we are, the kind of brains we have, the kind of people we are. Every one of us endures something different when we sit down to meditate. And we can imagine, like everybody else, because we're all sitting here quietly, we can imagine everybody else is just sitting there in a, you know, pure, thoughtless, peaceful state. But from what I've heard, most of us, that's not the case. And what's really interesting is there is the occasional person, very rare, who has a lot of mental control. I had a friend who, like, you know, the instructions to count your exhalations, 1 to 10. So you count and like, I mean, I would be like 1, 2. You know, then I don't know how much longer. All right, 1, 2. I mean, it was just impossible. I can do it sometimes now, like in retreat when I'm really still. Like I could do 1 to 10 maybe, and I'll be like, yes! But it's really because my mind is calmed down through other means that now it's just settled enough that I can, that the breath is the most interesting thing going on, not because I managed to wrestle my mind into. But some people do have this ability. And so my friend, she was just like, okay, so count 1 to 10. Now what? Like, all right, got that. Count 1 to 10, count 1 to 10, count 1 to 10, count 1 to 10. Now what? So, I mean, clearly, like, even though she had the ability to actually to control the mind in that way, it's not like it magically opens up this, you know, this thing that we're longing for. It's a different, you know, there still has to be this kind of realignment of our whole being to everything. And there's a tricky part where even if you do have that degree of control, then in some ways you end up thinking it is about your willful self. Your willful self has made this happen. And that's just something that you got to get over. So there's strengths and weaknesses to everyone's karma. I would like my mind to be slower, but then would I? Would I be the person that I am if my mind was slower? And those who suffer from anxiety or depression or self-critical thoughts or something like that, the more that you sit and endure that and get to know it and accept it and see it and eventually maybe even find some resolution of it, I mean, you are set up for like compassion and understanding of other people, you know. So in a way that if you haven't experienced that, you just can't really relate. So when we do this over and over, spontaneously we awaken from our trance-like state, where we're completely mesmerized by our own thoughts. We circumvent this whole realm of thinking and not thinking, dedicating to ourselves to some kind of simple meditative practice or object that doesn't depend on thought. We broaden our perspective. You know, whereas thought, when a thought is front and central, it's true. It defines the reality of our life. When we awaken and we shift to something else, thoughts, I mean, it's all still there, but it's just part of who we are. And because we're anchored in something other than the thoughts, it's like then we can see them like move and change, and we can understand like, oh, you know, I was feeling angry a moment ago, now I'm not. So there's the kind of unreality, the fluidity of our thoughts and beliefs and emotions becomes more apparent. And it becomes possible to, like the bumper sticker says, don't believe everything you think. It just becomes that process of doing that over and over and over. You know, so in like, I think it's like it's a cognitive behavioral therapy or whatever, where these people, they're not aiming for samadhi at all. But people can actually become freer of really, really negative thought and emotional patterns simply by learning to like return to their breath and become aware of their body, because it's this kind of opening up the perspective, shifting our alignment. And much of the transformation brought about by meditation is physical and unconscious. So it doesn't really matter if we think like, I don't know if I do this very well or if it's doing any good or whatever. It's, you know, in a way we can just see what difference it makes in our life. So we need determination, patience, humility, and faith to keep this up over time. Because a lot of times it's just not very much fun. Sometimes it's not very much fun to face the crap going on in your life, to face your own painful or negative thought patterns, to face the blender of your mind, to face the fact that you're not in control of what's in it. But if you find yourself saying something like, my meditation hasn't been going very well lately, or that wasn't a very good meditation period, I invite you to think about the fact that meditation is a practice, not a result. So what kind of effort were you making on the cushion? That's what your meditation practice is. The result, I don't know. Sometimes the samadhi can come, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes we're stressed, sometimes we're tired. I don't know. I don't know what it is that makes it, you know, sometimes I'll go through waves or weeks where my meditation is kind of, feels kind of good and rewarding, and then it'll just be like, I don't know what happened. So in a way, that kind of result is a little bit, I mean, obviously what we're doing has some influence on that result, but not as directly as we would like. So the practice is what we do when we awaken from that thought-centered trance. What do we do? And what is our attitude when we do it? Are we patient, subtle, gentle, humble, non-judgmental, non-greedy? You know, the more still that we can be at that moment when we let go, open the hand of thought, and turn our attention toward the meditation. My battery ran out. There we go. Oh, I see this thing fell out of my sleeve. That's how. Okay. So, what kind of attitude do we have when we let go? I mean, it's very difficult. It's very difficult for me not to have a little bit of a sense of frustration, a little bit of a sense of judgment, a little bit of sense of like determination, or like But really, the less crap we can add to that effort, the more still our meditation will become. The you know, the less we can register that change. So I just want to share one of my favorite metaphors for, I don't know if it's a metaphor, but images, metaphors for Zazen from Uchiyama Roshi, contemporary Japanese-American or Japanese priest. So and those of you who are in book group probably be familiar with this. So he's got a meditator, and this meditator is like moving through time, right? And there's the timeline Z to Z prime. And this is reality, right? So here's the person sitting, and you know, at any point, this is the reality of them sitting and meditating, and Z through Z prime is, you know, their meditation period. And as they go, like, thoughts occur to them, and they kind of, like, mentally depart from this reality. Or sometimes, like, a sleepy, you know, get into sleepiness and kind of depart from that line. And he says basically it's kind of the same thing. And I don't know if you've noticed, if you struggle with sleepiness at all, it'll usually start with some thought. But it's not a thought that really makes any sense, like the kind of thoughts that lead you off like this. They're like weird, random thoughts that lead you into a dream state. But that basically, so then you'll have a thought, and it'll lead to another thought, and you'll go off on this train of thought. But then when we awaken from that, then we return to Z prime, the little timeline there. So over and over, we just return to ZZ prime, which he says is, this is the reality of our life. You know, this is where we want to be. But he says the typical misunderstanding is that what we're aiming for is a state of ZZ prime, you know, not moving from that at all. And he said, that would be, you'd be dead. You'd be a rock. You would be... like, that is not the nature of human beings. We have life, we have desires, we have delusions, and they lead us off, but our practice is to return to ZZ prime over and over and over. Like, that is the practice, is just letting go and returning to that over and over, not killing ourselves off. Like, as long as we're alive, there will be this activity, this movement. But he says, as we do this practice, then we start to see everything, relate to everything as he calls it, the scenery of our life. And he says, there is scenery only where there is life. And happiness, unhappiness, delusion, craving, thoughts, meditation, good meditation, bad meditation, it's all just the scenery of our life. But he says, because we plunge into this scenery, become carried away by it, and end up running helter-skelter, we become frantic and we suffer. In Zazen, even though various life-like images appear to us, we are able to see this scenery of life for what it is by waking up to ZZ Prime. We aim at ZZ Prime even though we have a tendency to diverge from it. The very attitude of returning to ZZ Prime and waking up is the most important for practicing Zazen as the foundation of life. So if you think about it, the busier your mind is, the busier our mind is, the more opportunities we have for graciously just, you know, opening the hand of thought and returning to ZZ Prime. So, I mean, I guess I remember, like, I think, you know, occasionally somebody I'm giving an intro to will ask me, you know, does this get easier? Do you get better? How's, after 20 years, how's your meditation? You know, and they'll be like, well, you know, during a given meditation period, I might recognize, you know, like kind of wake, oh yeah, okay. Return to ZZ Prime. I don't know. You know, it's hard to count, but 15 times, 30 times, maybe more. And that sounds awful, right? Like all those times that I just kind of, you know, zoned out or departed or something. But then I thought, is that worse or better than when I started? And then like the meditation bell would ring, you know, like, and I might go the whole time without returning to ZZ Prime. You know, I guess it's better that, you know, that I'm waking up more often. So I'll leave it there. Don't have a lot of time left, but thoughts or, yeah.
It was interesting when I started practicing. I was under the impression that I had received the implication that experienced meditators were thoughtless. And it took me a long time to get over that, because for a very long time, I felt completely inadequate. Look at these people. They can do it for 25 minutes and kind of fall through. So, and thank you for it. And it took me, I mean, I sort of found this out on my own, that I could start to see grabbing towards this goal of thoughtlessness and, you know, feeling like a meditating failure because it wasn't. Thank you for reiterating it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky thing that, like,
I mean, you know, I kind of sympathize, I think, in a way, with teachers who don't confess. Because you don't want to discourage people, right? If somebody has that sense, like, I really do want to get free from these thoughts. I do want to experience some silence and quiet. So you know, be like, well, I don't know, I've been doing it for 25 years and I'm, you know, still just an endless train of thought. Like, people would be like, I don't know, is this worth it? Am I? But on the other hand, you know, so I can understand, and it's also easy, like, you can't see what's going on in my head, so I could just be like, you know. And I can, because you can allow that projection, and yet I personally feel like that is really, really harmful. If somebody keeps this up for more than a month, then they should be set straight about what really happened.
Yeah. I'm confused about Uchiyama Roshi's saying that when you're at ZZ Prime, you are rock. No, because if that's reality and that's where you are, you're more alive.
Well, he means if you were to be able to get yourself to some state where you never departed from that, never departed from it, that would entail a state of lifelessness. I mean, he's very clear that, like, in a way, like, the reality, we want to be awake to the reality of our life. Like, that is, you know, that's why he sings the praises of Zazen and living like that. But I don't know, there's that, our experience, and maybe this is kind of what I'm getting at with the line and the, you know, instructions for Zazen, which is like, this moment can't be grasped, and it's constantly shifting and changing. So I don't think, you know, even the most Buddha-like being is in some, I mean, there's always just thoughts and impulses and desires and feelings that are moving through. Maybe they don't depart very far from the line, but to be, I don't know, to never have a thought, to never have a feeling, would be to be dead.
It's not to have a thought or feeling. You do have those because you're alive. It's not getting lost in them. So you're still missing time because you're not getting lost in them.
Yes. You state the whole idea of thinking about thinking. There's an absurdity there. It's like you're putting the inmates in charge of the jail. And you're using this facility to examine. It's like, it doesn't seem, you know, how could that be useful?
And it's really
tricky if you like being in control and you like understanding. That is really tricky, because then you're like, okay, I've woken up from the trance of thought. Turning back to this meditative, like, it's so hard not to evaluate and, like, how can I improve my meditation and stop drifting off into thought and what's going on, like, you know, and then whereas, like, what meditation is asking us to do is just, to my mind, it's just like, just be really stupid. Just be like, oh, who cares? I don't know. I don't know if we're making any progress. I don't know what we're doing here at all. Just return your mind to the breath. Like, it's a stupid thing to do, my mind says. To just, like, well, how do you know? I mean, you've been doing this for so many years. Like, what's going on here? Are we making any progress? And yet, yeah, that's just the inmates in charge.
It's funny that you use an inmate metaphor, because if the goal is liberation, maybe we want to put them in charge of the jail.
And they probably are anyway.
Yeah.
I liked your reference to providing the conditions. Because I think that is really important in some way. It feels like the implication is that stuff is going to go on anyway, but your intent is simply to provide space for it and forget the rest.
And that's why I feel like there's a whole...
And I've written some podcasts on this of, like, you know, how do you awaken without trying? How do you do this? Like, where do you put your effort? Clearly you have to put some effort in, because otherwise you're just going to sit there and think about TV shows. Like, what kind of effort is it? And it's just like, I feel like that we can work on our willingness, on our trust. So it's, to me anyway, it feels much less like building a mental discipline. I mean, there's some teachers that use that language, and I feel like that's a real, like, directed effort approach. For me, it's like, it's converting myself to being willing, you know. And sometimes you've got to be a little tough with yourself. Like, come on. You got plenty of time to think about that. Do you want to meditate now? You know, you're here for 25 minutes. Do you want to do this or not? Like, you could give yourself a little pep talk.
I always say, can't we talk about this later?
Exactly.
Do we have to do this now?
And like, that's what I tell people when they come for an intro. I'm like, if there's really something that you should be doing or thinking about right now, then you shouldn't be meditating. You should be dealing with it, right? So really, there's no excuse when meditating. No excuse whatsoever. There's really nothing that we have to be analyzing or planning or fixing.
Can you show me
said something like that about one of the books that she was writing, but don't ask me which book it was. Because she was used to getting up in the morning and meditating right away, but now she was getting up at 4 a.m. and working on her book. And she said, "You're not meditating." And she says, "Yes, because that's not what I want to do now. I want to work on this book." So she acknowledged that, accepted that, and got up at 4 a.m. and worked on her book.
I particularly liked your initial concept of the blender, but for me, I turned it on its side, and it's the washing machine, the front-load washing machine with the clothes just and the soap and everything just swirling around.
Yeah.
Even though it runs slower, it's still you can't identify anything that's actually there. And to Richard's comment about thinking about thinking, I thought immediately, self-diagnostic. You know, you just run this little program going, okay, hands are working, yep. You know, just going through the full diagnostic, but mentally. Fascinating. Thank you much.
You turn your head on the stick. It's all up here. Yeah. And that's one of the things, where is that thought? Go down the rest. Go down to the bottom. Mm-hmm. There's things going on.
I just have to ask two things. Did Hogan identify Rourke as being an idiot's guide?
He did say it was an idiot's guide, but it wasn't until the closing circle after the retreat that he said he wrote it.
Oh, that's the second question. Did he say he wrote it?
Yeah. And then I don't know, I think he just kind of didn't want to embarrass me during such, you know, a little distracting. Yeah. Like,
well, everybody's got to be quiet,
so. But it was kind of funny because I totally forgot. And I'm like, keep reading, I don't know what I said next. All right, well, is anybody going to lunch?
For sure.
Wow. All right. I mean, I'm just imagining that you guys have meditation to talk about. Yeah. All right. Thank you all. Oh, sorry. I have a formal end to the dark talk. I'm used to this someday. I got the beginning down now.
Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita.